Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Before we get to the interviews today, folks, I'd like to tell you about a friend of mine. For those of you who have heard this show over a long period of time, or even last week's episode, you'll know the story of Karen Barr, a woman who bravely fought stage 4 cancer and won. It's my sad duty to report that she passed on this past week. However, her friends and loved ones gathered together to honor her memory. And it was amazing to see, you know, just that so many people cared about the impact this woman had. She struggled at times with her disability, she told me. But her strength, her dignity, and her courage will continue to be an inspiration forever. She'll be missed, but she remains a symbol that a person with a disability should never give up, that no matter what obstacles may be in the way, you can deal with it. And there's a strength in each of us that transcends what we know is possible. We can reach inside ourselves and live at our best, no matter the circumstances. And that is what I learned from her. Farewell, my friend. Now, on to the interviews. The first one up is a native performance artist who suffers from whiplash.
This is Cam Wells here with
Aqua.
Will be telling me a little bit about her story, disability life, and how things have affected her. So, what can you tell me?
Well, I actually grew up very physically able, very strong body, very strong mind and spirit and heart. However, I was raised by such a strong single mom that she worked 3 jobs while raising my brother and I on her own. And she continually got injured and did not allow herself time to heal and continued to push herself because she believed she needed to provide for my brother and I to have a good life. So she worked so hard that eventually she got degenerative disc disease and was bedridden. It was pretty tough as a child for her in terms of her ability to get around, but also complete tasks that help take care of us as children. So cooking and cleaning and going up the stairs and getting out of the house. And so at a very young age, I became pretty self-sufficient and I helped take care of my mom. I helped provide for my family. It definitely made my brother and I stronger. But my mom had a very important kind of journey of learning what her abilities were instead of re-injuring and getting to a point where she can't walk. And that took a really long time for her to figure out. And so now, at 30 years old, she does more than she ever did because she had to really figure out. And there's still things that limits her in her life. But one of the things as a child she had to make a decision on was she went to the doctor and they offered her surgery that would 50% chance would kind of cure her spine and fix her and she'd be back to what she was, which was working a lot, or 50% chance she'd never walk again, and she'd be in a wheelchair. And she made the decision based on my brother and I. She couldn't imagine raising us in a wheelchair. And obviously, this is possible, but it's something that very much scared her. For myself, I recently, 4 months ago, got a pretty severe concussion and whiplash from my indigenous martial arts, Okichita. And I ignored it. And now my life has really, really changed. Even though I'm 4 months out of this injury, I have post-concussion syndrome. I cannot be in public places, restaurants. My work has really been affected. I have to protect my ears. I am very sensitive to stimulus. So not just sound and light, but also motion, screens around. And if you pay attention in the city, there are screens everywhere.
I noticed.
Yeah, which is, I mean, for me, I'm not a fan. And also scent. So even, you know, there's a lot of scent in terms of the chemicals and the cleaners and the perfumes that are used in the city. I get very confused now. So I used to have a very sharp mind in terms of directions and getting around. And now I get confused very easily. Even going to places I've already been in the past, I look at signs and I don't read them right. I get lost. I get turned around. I get overwhelmed. So things have changed where I need really clear directions. I need help finding my way when I'm coming to, because I'm a performer, going to places. And I've made really big mistakes getting to gigs that I've already been at that location because I get confused now. So I have more humility and more understanding. That might be one of their challenges, because I never experienced that before. And I don't think for myself and anyone I know who's gotten a concussion will ever be the same in terms of being able to be exposed to so many stimulus. And when you go in public, there's so many levels and layers of stimuli.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the supports you've used since your injury, things that have helped you cope?
Yeah, I actually, what's really cool is there is this person that came to one of my performances, my first performance after my concussion, and he had a really bad concussion, and he sent me all these resources that within Toronto, they have a brain injury society, which I did not know about, and so they have tons of resources, and then I have a couple of close friends who got concussions, so they also sat down with me and guided me. I see a chiropractor who specializes in neurology and concussion rehabilitation. So I have exercises and ongoing rehab for my brain. I see a healer who is a shaman for cranial sacral work. Because it was also whiplash, my spine was completely out of line and I was in pain all the time. And I'm sober and I don't take painkillers. So it's really been a mixture of a lot of people. My mom, actually, one of the things she contributed was she works with this doctor who basically doesn't believe in the pharmaceutical companies, and I don't either, because I'm sober and I don't take medications, and I'm on a plethora of vitamins and supplements that help feed my brain and help the inflammation in my body from this injury. So it was really a mixture of many people and their knowledge base, but it was a big piece of it was asking for help.
That's one of the greatest strengths anyone with any disability can run into. Finding the strength to say, I can't do this on my own, I do need the right supports. So if you could send any message to the community about your journey and your healing and what others in the same situation should know, what would you say?
Oh, people that have had concussions, like, I am so sorry, and I know how dark it is, and dark literally being in the dark room for a long time to let your brain heal, it really takes time, and it's unfortunate, and I've tried to rush it, and I've gone back to training, and it's only led to more injury. So sometimes really taking a step back, really slowing down, it's frustrating and it's hard, but you deserve to have the best care to heal. And know that sometimes it can feel like everything you love is taken from you when your abilities have changed, but you can still have the things you love. It's just in a different way, and you might not see that way, and that's why connecting with other people who have been through the same experience about how you can still nourish yourself, your spirit, and your heart without harming yourself, without it being so difficult. And know that you're not alone. And know that injury and disability and all varying abilities does not make a weak person. It makes an incredibly strong person with a lot of humility.
Thank you very much.
The next segment of our show, we're going to hear a little bit from our friend Ken Pope. You've done a lot of information and some sessions out there about what's available for a person with a disability. What happens when they don't have this information, when they don't know what they're entitled to?
Well, it's fascinating to me because what happens is one or two decades go by, and then they hear from a friend that someone else gets more ODSP benefits, or somebody has an RDSP and they don't, and all of a sudden they realize that nobody told them. Somebody else knows. Everybody else seems to know, but they don't know. And it's unfortunate, but the bureaucrats that actually should have a duty, a fiduciary duty, to inform people, especially people with special needs, about all of the various social supports and benefits and things that could be to their advantage. That information is not disclosed. It is not generally given out in any transparent way. It's in fact withheld or misled. People are told information that, if they believe it, because it may be in part true, leads them to an incorrect conclusion to their detriment. So where is the duty on the part of the bureaucrats to tell people the information they should know about, for example, increased benefits or supplementary supports, special diets, those kinds of things, increased benefits when people move out of their family home and into another place. And I'll give you the term for this, the fact that people aren't given the information they need. It's called bureaucratic disentitlement. Because we know for a fact that all of the ODSP staff know about these things. Why don't they have some kind of advocate or ombudsman? That's my little rant for the morning. But what happens is people find out just through the grapevine, and then they inquire, and then they're advised, oh, no, that doesn't apply to you. So there's just really no system in place to give people the information that they should be given. And you would think in many cases that if you're dealing with some bureaucracy, whether it's a private bureaucracy or a civil service bureaucracy, public bureaucracy, that their job would be to tell people what they could qualify for.
So,
but there's none of that going on.
So what steps would you suggest people can take to just get better informed for their own situations?
Well, I think that they should take part in support groups, self-help support groups, share information. Of course, I have a number of videos on my website that freely tell people about all of these things, so they could go to kpopelaw.com and find out, of course. Of course, that doesn't deal with all the people who have disabilities who aren't really capable of doing these things.
So
obviously, about a third of the population that would be not competent to find this out themselves, So, of course, they would rely upon their family, their parents, their siblings. And as for those people, the parents and siblings who are my main clients, well, they can always call us, of course, or email us and watch videos. But it's a constant process. It's just a matter of, you know, as children age and go through different living situations, of jumping through new hoops and finding out the new information. Just a constant process for every family.
So, have there been any recent changes you'd like the public to be aware of in terms of what's available for funding?
Well, for funding, I find there's lots of people who are not aware of passport funding for the respite for family for children over 18. There's lots that don't know about special services at home when the children are under 18. There are lots of single parents that don't know about assistance for children with severe disabilities when they have a low household income and a child with special needs. So there's passport, special services at home, ACSD, all of those good things. Those are just basic. And then on the tax level side of things, there was a change in the caregiver credit back in 2017. And it used to be that if you were a caregiver for an adult child, age 18 and over, they had to live with you. And if they did, then this caregiver credit would reduce your taxes by $1,000 a year. But that would only apply to the 13% of people on ODSP, the 46,000 people on ODSP who are living with family. However, in 2017, the reside with criteria was removed. So now the caregiver credit, in my opinion, should apply to the 365,000 families in the province who have a child receiving ODSP. And that's a big number, to jump from 46,000 to 365,000. And it saves those families $1,000 a year. So it's 365,000 times 1,000, which is a big number. And, of course, nobody knows about this. Nobody, you know, said, oh, gee, it's changed. You should use this credit. And you don't get this from accountants. You know, tax issues are not something that support groups typically know anything about. But that's the single biggest one that I can think of that's dead simple to apply for almost everybody.
Like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Excellent.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Multicultural Council of Windsor and Essex County presents the 44th Annual Carousel of Nations, running throughout Windsor from June 14th to the 16th and from the 21st to the 23rd. The Multicultural Council is also excited to announce that in 2019, Carousel of Nations will include 4 villages in Leamington. This year, Carousel of Nations becomes the longest-running festival in Windsor and the oldest cultural festival in all of Ontario. For 2019, the theme is Celebrating Culture, Treasuring Tradition, a call to honor our customs, our past, and our roots. Carousel of Nations is an opportunity to showcase the many wonderful elements that multiculturalism has brought to Windsor and Essex County. For dates and locations of 16 villages in Windsor, 4 in Leamington, and more information, visit carouselofnations.com.
Welcome back, HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from native performance artist Aqua and Ken Pope. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Aaron Boudreau, who will be telling us a little bit about justice and mental health for those affected with schizophrenia. So tell me a little bit about justice and mental health for those with schizophrenia.
Sure. So there are many reasons that individuals with mental illness, such as schizophrenia, can end up in contact with the law or police. Many of those involve negative stereotypes and misconceptions about the risk of violence. And crimes which are directly related to the symptoms of their condition, such as causing a disturbance, mischief, or minor theft, and the role of police officers as first responders to mental health crises. So often, or in some cases with individuals who have serious mental illness, because they have been unable to access services in the community timely, it can lead to, because of only symptoms of their illness, contact with the law. And that is strictly related to the fact that they, you know, were unable to access timely support, and as a result of that, have somehow come into contact. And police are responding to behaviors. And at that time, you know, police can either divert the individual out of the justice system and into a community program or a support program for help.
So how do you go about supporting these individuals and clearing up those myths and misperceptions you mentioned?
Absolutely. There's a couple of ways, and I think the first thing is, of course, public education. We're out there as an organization actively educating the public on what schizophrenia is and what it isn't. We're out there debunking myths and dispelling the stigma. And one of the things is that we like to say is that people with schizophrenia are more likely to be the victim of a crime than the perpetrator. They are, in fact, more likely to harm themselves than others. And I think undercutting all of this is the fact that, like with any or most chronic illnesses, the earlier we can intervene and get help, the better that person's outcomes can be. Schizophrenia, like many chronic illnesses, is a very treatable condition, and you know what that treatment looks like for every individual varies. It is a very individualized illness. And then on that note, what we can do is ensure that we have more access to community-based supports across Ontario. Right now, in the space of schizophrenia, we do not have enough when compared to other conditions. And depending on where you live in Ontario, access to those services can get harder and harder. In some areas in Ontario, the waits can be years long. And for somebody who is in crisis, even one day, you know, an hour and a half could be too long. So we, as an organization, do a lot of advocacy to improve investment in serious mental illness and community support. And the community aspect is huge because people just do better when they get help closer to home, and we know that. And it is not uncommon for individuals with schizophrenia to access support through hospital. For some, that is their entry point to services. However, when they are released from hospital, it's where do they go? And we need to ensure that we have more community services in place so that we can help them in their recovery. And the other thing is that we fostered really positive relationships, in particular with the Toronto Police, but educating our police to better respond and effectively respond to people in crisis is very, very important. We've previously done police training with various police services across Ontario, and the goals of that training are to build capacity of police officers to better respond to people with mental health issues, to increase their knowledge and sensitivity around mental health and mental illnesses. Right now, more than ever, at least in Toronto, the Toronto Police are responding to numerous calls related to persons who are in crisis as a result of a mental health issue. And again, it goes back to one of my original points of that being due to that individual not having help in the community when they need it. Our training also provides police with practical tools and strategies to foster better verbal and nonverbal communication with people who might be experiencing a mental health crisis. And also, just increasing police's knowledge about what community resources are available to them. So when they do have an interaction with an individual, they know where to send that person to for continued help. We also need to work, this goes back to the stigma piece, to decrease negative police perceptions of people with mental health issues. Certainly in Toronto, they are making huge strides in improving how they respond to persons in crisis, understanding stigma, taking the time to understand mental illness. And then we also need to decrease the negative consequences of police interactions with people who have mental health issues. So, you know, zero harm, no psychological harm involved. And our training also that we have done has been developed with people who have lived experience with schizophrenia, and also has consisted of individuals with the illness also assisting in delivering that training. So I think learning firsthand and hearing firsthand from people who have schizophrenia is critical to increasing empathy and understanding of the illness.
So I'm curious about one thing. You mentioned nonverbal communication with those affected. What do you do if someone doesn't pick up on a nonverbal cue that this is not a safe situation for them? How do you go
providing support.
I think this is when, you know, we have to keep drawing on de-escalation training that police receive. De-escalate, 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 repeat, repeat, repeat. And I think that's also, and, you know, and other services in place that can assist with that too are things like mobile crisis intervention teams. We don't have enough of those, and that's usually a nurse who would accompany a police officer to better assist and respond to somebody who is in crisis and who can perhaps, better communicate with that individual and know what to do. But, you know, we would encourage police just to keep drawing on that de-escalation, you know, and getting the situation under control. And then, again, making sure that they're aware of the supports in their surroundings that they can actually refer that person to. And understand. And then it's also taking a step back and understanding, you know, some of the symptoms of mental illness and what behaviors they are responding to.
So in your time working with justice and mental health, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I think just in our work with, and I can only speak to the Toronto Police, but it's been incredibly encouraging to see the leadership that they're taking to train their officers in de-escalation and in developing sensitivity and sympathy for people who might be in crisis. And they have come such a long way from even 5 years ago to now and how they respond to crisis situations and are doing an incredible job of involving community partners like ourselves and our other partners as part of that discussion, you know, developing a strategy to, again, better respond, and I think to also better support themselves as a service, too, you know, following responses to calls, but really, really taking the time to practice the de-escalation, understand those techniques, and to do no harm at all. And again, those community fostering community connections is crucial because then they know where to send people for help. But I think to me that would be a significant gain. And to say nothing of the fact, too, that I think we have come we've come further in educating the public about mental health in general. So I think we can see that, you know, stigma. We are starting to bust some of that stigma. And then, you know, and recently we've had some great conversations, too, with even media just about schizophrenia to start spreading the word and so people can have a better understanding. So I think those are some great gains.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you
thank
can
you
stay
for the opportunity.
Of course. What really spoke to me today, folks, is people with disabilities following their dreams. In the interview with performance artist Aqua, she talked about how her art really is her passion. And that's what it should be for a person with a disability. I mean, they should follow what they want to do, no matter how society might view it. It's not a question or a right of anyone to tell you, no, you can't have this dream, or no, you can't do that. It's your life and your path to follow. If you believe you can, try. If it doesn't work, try something else. Find a way. Live at your best. Follow the things you want to do. And that's something I really learned from Karen. She inspired me, not so much just with her words, but also the way she lived, with dignity and strength. And she firmly believed that the world was a place of potential and hope. That was something she shared with me. That's something all of us should keep in mind when we look to that horizon. We should say, sure, things aren't what I'd like them to be today. What about tomorrow? What can I build into this world that will make it a little bit better? And that, my dear friends, where that all-important sense of community comes in, with people working together to achieve things. It becomes a force to be reckoned with. One person alone might have a harder time achieving their dreams, but if they find the right support and the right motivation, they'll find a way. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.